I'd like to turn to 1 Peter this morning, the book of 1 Peter chapter 2, and as you turn, remember that Peter, in his opening words, identifies himself as an apostle of Jesus Christ, a sent one, a messenger of Jesus Christ, which means what we'll read this morning is the message of Jesus for us. We want to take that seriously. 1 Peter chapter 2, and we'll read verses 11 and 12. Dearly beloved, I beseech you as strangers and pilgrims, abstain from fleshly lusts which war against the soul, having your conversation honest among the Gentiles, that whereas they speak against you as evildoers, they may, by your good works, which they shall behold, glorify God in the day of visitation. Several years ago, I was in a supermarket, and I overheard one of those conversations that wasn't meant for me, but that I heard anyway, and I really couldn't help it. And this lady was talking with somebody, and apparently unbelievers, not Christians, because what she said to him was this. She said, if anyone comes to you and says, I'm a Christian, you better hold on to your wallet. I was in a conversation with my brother-in-law later, but several years ago, and he is a Christian, and he happens to do work for people on their houses. He mows their grass, kind of a jack of all trades, but he works for a lot of different people. And it was interesting what he told me as a Christian about the people he works for. And he told me that he almost doesn't want to work for Christians anymore. And if you ask him why, he'll tell you because what tends to happen is they'll call you from a long distance to come give an estimate, and it becomes evident that they have not even any plans to consider your estimate. Their only reason in calling to get your estimate is to take it to somebody else so he can do the work at your price. Or maybe they'll give you the job, and then at some point along the way, they'll try to throw in a little extra work while you're here. Can you do this? Or maybe they'll change the price that they agreed on. Well, that's exactly the opposite of what Peter is encouraging us to do in this text. When Peter tells us to have our conversation honest, our way of life honest, that's exactly the opposite of what I've just described to you. In Uruguay, we live in the capital city of Montevideo, and we end up riding the bus quite a bit, because we don't have a car. But one of the reasons, the main reason we don't have a car is because there's a very well-developed public transportation system, and it really works well for us to ride the bus where we need to go most of the time. And what happens in Montevideo is that as you're riding and going from stop to stop, people will get on, and some of those people are actually licensed, approved to sell things to you on the bus. So they'll get on the bus stop, and they'll try to sell you their candy or their household item that you just can't do without. And then they'll get off at the next stop, and maybe somebody else will get on. Well, from time to time, other people get on as well, and they'll tell you another story, and sometimes they're trying to sell you something too, and they'll tell you that they had a fire in their house just recently, and they are just trying to make ends meet, and can you help them? Or they'll insist that the money that they're asking for will go to the food for their family, the pot, as they say. And so as Christians, you find yourself wanting to help, and from time to time we can and do. But what happens is if you see that person on the bus next month and he's telling you the same story, you start to wonder, is he actually figuring this is a better way to make money than getting a job? Or you see somebody that you tried to help in the grocery store the next day and he's buying something to feed a vice. And what can happen is that we see people get on the bus and we identify them and we automatically look at them with a jaded eye and we think He's after my money. Hang on to your wallet. Those aren't necessarily Christian people, but it's the kind of reaction we're talking about. Well, what does Peter say that we should live like? What should people's response be to us when we get on the bus, or when we show up at work, or when we arrive at a function or an event on a Saturday evening? Peter says, in essence, if you look again at verses 11 and 12, he says in two ways, a negative way and a positive way. Verse 11, the negative is abstain from fleshly lusts. There are things we should not be doing. And then verse 12, the positive side, having your conversation honest. There are things we should be doing. And in essence, negatively, positively, Peter is saying something like this: as Christians, you ought to live excellent lives. And he's basing that exhortation in our identity, if you look at verse 11, our identity is what? He says, I beseech you. He could have said, as children of God, that would have been good. As servants of Christ, that would have been good. But he says, I beseech you as strangers and pilgrims. So he's basing what he's going to exhort us to do in our identity as pilgrims. So Peter's telling us, because you're pilgrims, live excellent lives. Because this is your identity, strangers and pilgrims, live lives that are excellent. Now, that may bring questions to your mind. You may be thinking, what is being a pilgrim? I kind of understand what that is. What does that have to do with my living a certain way? Okay, I understand I'm a pilgrim. Peter calls us pilgrims. But what does that have to do with the way I live? I think if we look at 1 Peter as a whole, and specifically at these two verses, we're going to see several realities. Actually, we're going to look at three. Three realities of the pilgrim life that should affect the way I live. Because we're pilgrims, we should live excellent lives. In at least three areas, or three realities of that kind of life that should affect the way that we live. First of all, I'd like to look at the big picture of 1 Peter. I don't know how long it's been since you've read through 1 Peter, but Peter actually is doing something. He's not just writing off the top of his head. He has a plan. And one reason I know that is that I look at 1 Peter at the very end of the book, and we can turn there very quickly. 1 Peter chapter 5 and verse 12. It's one of those verses that if we're not careful, we just sort of skip over it or read through it quickly on our way to the end of the book. But verse 12 of chapter 5 is actually very helpful in understanding what Peter's doing with this book, with this short letter. He says, by Silvanus, a faithful brother unto you, as I suppose, I have written briefly. That's interesting to me, because when I'm thinking about the whole theme of 1 Peter, and Peter says something about his writing, that often is helpful if you can grab those clues and interpret them. He says, I have written briefly, exhorting. So there's the first thing he says about his writing. He is exhorting. And do we find exhortation in 1 Peter? Absolutely. There's a lot of it. Peter is exhorting us. And then he is, secondly, testifying. I have written briefly, first exhorting, and then testifying. And that testifying has to do with something. He's testifying about, he says here, testifying that this is the true grace of God. So what we can expect if we go back here at the end of the book, we can go back at the beginning and read through it again. What we can expect to see is Peter talking about the grace of God and exhorting. And the connection between those two, he says, this is the true grace of God wherein ye stand. It's as if that grace of God is the foundation, and we're standing on that, and because of what God has done or is doing or will do, we should live a certain way. So with that sort of the backdrop, actually we can see some examples of that really quickly. In chapter 1, first of all, Peter starts out by talking about the grace of God. In this case, it's grace that is yet to be, but it's secure. It's in heaven waiting for us. There's no doubt about it. It's a living hope. And verse 4, it's an inheritance incorruptible, undefiled, that fadeth not away, reserved in heaven for you. And several verses that just ought to really excite us, motivate us about what's waiting for us as Christians. And then Peter says in verse, if we jump down to the very end of that section, verse 13, after he says all this about the salvation that we enjoy, in verse 13 he says, wherefore, or therefore, based on that, live this way. Gird up the loins of your mind, be sober, etc. An example of what Peter's doing in his book. He's talking about the grace of God and says, therefore, live this way. Another example would be in verse 22 of chapter 1. 1 Peter 1:22, seeing ye have purified your souls in obeying the truth through the Spirit unto unfeigned love of the brethren. Since this is true, you have purified your souls, he says here, but this is talking about salvation. Since this is true, therefore see that ye love one another. So Peter tells us this is what he's done, and then we see examples of it. This is God's grace, therefore live this way. So when we get to chapter 2, verses 11 and 12 that we just read, Peter is basing his exhortation, yes, in our being a pilgrim. What does that have to do with my life, my daily life? Well, remember that Peter's talking about the grace of God, and that affects the way we live. And our being pilgrims is part of that grace of God to us. It's actually not a bad thing to be a pilgrim. It's a very good thing. It's God's grace that we are sort of here displaced. It's actually God's choice that we're here displaced. It's not something that happened and God is sort of working with the fallout of that. God has made us pilgrims. In verse just before this section in verse 9, God says, Peter writes, ye are a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a peculiar people. God did that. You're different. The fact that you're a pilgrim is part of God's grace. And in light of Peter's message, we can say it this way. Because you're a pilgrim, by God's grace, the first reality, you ought to live excellent lives. Now that's general. That's actually true throughout the Bible. We see that pattern. Because God has worked in my life, I should live a certain way. The epistles are full of this, aren't they? Paul starts saying, this is what's true in Christ. Therefore, practically, love one another, for example. Or husbands, love your wives. Practically, live this way. Peter's doing the same kind of thing. Because you are pilgrims by God's grace, God's unmerited favor, live excellent lives. But returning right to these verses, what is Peter saying? Not only are you pilgrims by God's grace, but there's a second reality that comes straight from these verses. Verse 11, dearly beloved, I beseech you as strangers and pilgrims. Do you like that next word? Abstain. Is that a positive word or a negative word? Well, I just said it's a negative, the negative side, right? It's a negative and positive, that's the negative side. But when I hear abstain, I don't generally like that word. Do you? The children are gone to children's church, but do our kids like it when we say no? You can't have another one of those. And if we're not careful, we think like our kids. We get this idea of God that God is very good at identifying what we really want to do and then telling us you can't do that. We think that way sometimes, don't we? And when we hear a word abstain, we think, great, I probably wanted to do that and God's telling me no. Well, as parents, we know it's not the case, right? When we say, no, you can't have another honey bun, it's because the first one was already too many. And we know, at least to some degree, as parents, what's good and what's not for our kids, and we are actually trying to protect them from what's actually going to hurt them. Well, what do we think God is like? And remember, as Christians, the process of growth to be more like Christ comes as we think differently. We let the Word of God change the way we think, and we're thereby transformed. The Spirit is involved in this process, but we're trying to think like God thinks. And when God says abstain from fleshly lusts, why does he say that? You could say, God doesn't have to tell me why. Well, that's true, but often he does. He tells me why, and here he does too. Abstain from fleshly lusts. What's that next part? Which, he's not just giving us extra information here. It's here for a reason. Abstain from fleshly lusts, and part of the reason is they are at war against your soul. Now, today was Father's Day. We had the Father's Stand. Maybe on other Lord's Days, you have Veterans Stand. And what do we know, at least in theory, about war? We just remember D-Day a couple weeks ago. And what was that like? We celebrate D-Day, but what was that like? There were people shooting our soldiers down one by one on the beach. In other words, war is a situation where people are trying to kill you. Abstain from fleshly lusts, because those desires, those lusts, want to kill you. They are at war against your soul. And we have to submit our thinking to God's thinking. That God is not just identifying what we want to do and saying no. He is actually protecting us, and he says these desires want to kill you. That's the second reality. You are pilgrims at war. Pilgrims at war. Therefore, abstain. Therefore, live excellent lives. What are these desires? The word is lusts, but the real meaning here is just desires, fleshly desires. What are those desires that war against our soul? Well, those desires aren't always bad, are they? We have desires that are not bad. Jesus was tempted, for example, to eat in the desert. Is it wrong to eat? Not usually, but can it be wrong to eat? It can be. The marriage relationship, good or bad, not just legitimate, it's actually very good. This is God's plan. But apart from God's parameters, it is a fleshly desire that is at war against your soul. And we have to think about these desires in that way. Outside of God's parameters, within God's parameters, very, very good. Outside of God's parameters, death. These desires wage war against our souls. Where are these desires? How do I identify them? We probably don't even need to go there. 1 John chapter 2, verses 15 through 17. We're familiar with those. We're very close. So let's just go there. Even though we're familiar with those verses, just a few pages over, 1 John chapter 2, verse 15. John is writing and he says, love not the world. Now, we're talking about being pilgrims. Pilgrims are people who are living somewhere, but they're not of that place. They're living actually for another time and another place. They're in the world, whatever world means, talk about that in a minute, but they're living somewhere, but they're not, in one sense, they belong, they're comfortable there, they speak the same language, but in another real sense, they're not. They're from another place. Well, John says, love not the world. What is he talking about here? There are things we are not supposed to love, and he says, love not the world. What does that word mean? John has already said in John 3:16, God so loved the world. So what is God telling us? God loved the world. Now he's telling us, love not the world. What's the answer? Well, maybe it's a different Greek word. No, it's not. It's the same word. What is this difference? Well, I think we know, right? God so loved the world in the sense of he loved the people. God so loved the people of the world. And we're not at war against the people. When Peter says, in essence, we're pilgrims at war, we're not at war with people. We're at war with something else. There are fleshly desires that wage war against our souls. We're working on figuring out what those desires are. John says, love not the world. He's not talking about the people. He's not really talking about the planet. Paul, preaching, said, God who created the world and everything in it, goes on to say something else, but he identifies God as the creator of this planet and everything in it. So he's not talking about the physical thing. God created everything good. John here isn't saying don't love the mountains. Certainly those can be idols, and that can be part of the world in the sense John is using the word. But he's not really talking about the planet. What's he talking about? Well, he goes on and he says, love not the world, neither the things that are in the world. Why? Verse 16. For or because all that is in the world, it's those desires. Same desires Peter talks about. The world is characterized by certain desires that are anti-God. The desires of the flesh is the first thing he mentions. So we can say, if we're saying, okay, I'm a pilgrim at war, those desires are trying to kill me. Where are they? How do I identify them? Well, first of all, they're in the world. There is this sphere that is against God that John calls the world. This realm that is against God, it's characterized by these desires. It's not necessarily a place, although you go to Walmart and often you're within that sphere. It's not wrong to go to Walmart or even the mall, but just know that the sphere that John calls the world is there. And it's characterized by the desires of the flesh, the desires of the eyes, the pride of life. But those desires that are kind of out there, the world, sometimes unfortunately in here among us, I think we can say that those are the things we desire, right? There's another sense in which those desires are inside us. I have an internal desire that desires what's out there in the world. And James talks about that. He says, when any man's tempted, let him not say he's being tempted by God. Because God does not tempt. God cannot be tempted by evil. But everyone is tempted when what? He's drawn away of his own lusts or his own desires. So yes, there are these desires, these things that attract me, that tempt me, the desires kind of in an external objective sense out there in the world. But the problem is that there are these desires in my heart. And like a Trojan horse, are there responding to those temptations. That's dangerous. And that is what we have to identify and then think biblically about. And part of that is saying with Peter that those desires are at war against my soul. Now, obviously, there's a lot more we could say about temptation and how to respond to temptation and sanctification. But 1 Peter 2:11 and 12 at least makes this point. We are pilgrims at war. Those desires are trying to kill us. We need to recognize that. There's a third reality. Not only are we pilgrims by God's grace, and that should affect the way we live. We should live excellent lives because we're pilgrims by grace. And not only are we pilgrims at war, which should affect the way we live, there's a third reality. And it's verse 12. It's this positive side. Really, we're looking at the whole command together. But here Peter says, having your conversation honest among the Gentiles, that, I'm going to say it this way, you are pilgrims, I am a pilgrim, we are pilgrims on mission. That word that or so that is giving us a reason or a purpose or a result that God intends that there be. Live this way so that something happens. We're not just here sort of getting through the day. We are actually here with a purpose. We are on mission. What is that mission according to these verses? Having your conversation honest among the Gentiles so that, if you just jump down to the very end of that verse, it has to do with glorifying God. So that God will be glorified. Let's just think about that before we look at the details of the rest of the verse. We understand the difference, don't we, about living with purpose or not. Deborah tells me when she was a girl living in the interior of Uruguay that going to Montevideo was a big event. A big city. Her daddy would take her to Montevideo to run errands and they'd eat something nice. To go to Montevideo was almost like to go to this city where the streets were made of gold, and it was a fun experience. Well, now we live in Montevideo, and probably she wouldn't say the same thing about Montevideo. We enjoy Montevideo, but the streets are not made of gold, and there's a lot of other stuff about living in Montevideo. In fact, sometimes we have to go downtown. And we like going downtown, but usually when we go, there's some reason we're going. You're going on a mission. You're going to run an errand, get this done, take care of business. Well, you can go to Montevideo with your dad and just enjoy the day, sort of have fun. Or you can go to Montevideo with a purpose. We understand that difference, right? What is our purpose on earth as Christians? Let me give you a clue. It's not just to accumulate stuff. It's not just to have fun. There is a reason we're here, and part of the answer to that question is that God be glorified. It's probably the question, all-encompassing question. But what does that look like here? Live excellent lives, abstain from fleshly desires, having your conversation honest among the Gentiles, so that specifically, whereas they speak against you as evildoers. Does that happen sometimes as Christians? Do you show up? Do you know somebody who shows up at work and people say, hold on to your wallet? Unfortunately, sometimes those things are true. There is unfortunately reasons people say those kinds of things when Christians show up. But sometimes do people speak evil against you unjustly? That happens, doesn't it? Sometimes just we're Christians, we're trying to do the right thing, and people say things that aren't true. It happens. Peter acknowledges it. Whereas they speak against you as evildoers, yet they may, by your good works, which they shall behold, glorify God. So you're at work and somebody is spreading a rumor that you're dishonest or that you're just out to get what benefits you. What do you do? Well, okay, instead of any other reaction, why don't we just say, okay, I'm being accused of this. I'm going to, by my good works, prove that rumor wrong. I'm going to live in such a way that it's just evident that I am not out for myself, that I'm really seeking the good of others. And what is the result of that? Potentially, that people would see that and glorify God. When will this happen? Peter says, in the day of visitation. That might refer to the return of Christ. That's very possible. But if you look at this whole flow of thought in this section of 1 Peter, I don't think Peter is just saying that someday at the return of Christ, people will glorify God. He may be saying that. But Peter is not thinking that we just have to wait until then. Because if you keep reading, he talks about the possibility that in verse 13, the very next verse, that as we submit ourselves to every ordinance of man for the Lord's sake, it is possible that in verse 15, so is the will of God, that with well-doing, talking about our works, like Peter does in 11 and 12, your good works, that by well-doing you might put to silence the ignorance of foolish men. This can happen this week, perhaps, at work. Peter then talks about husbands and wives, and in chapter 3, he says, likewise, ye wives, it's possible that you have a husband that doesn't obey the word. He doesn't sign up for the prayer advance. But often it's worse than that, isn't it? I mean, often, that's funny, but often women find themselves in very difficult circumstances. And what does Peter say? Well, he doesn't say don't give the gospel. But here he's not focusing on that, because he says that if any obey not the word, they also may, without the word, or without a word, without speaking, it's possible that these disobedient husbands will be won. So Peter is not thinking that we have to wait till Christ returns for God to be glorified. Back in verse 12, he says, it's possible that by your good works, which they shall behold, unsaved men and women may glorify God. That's why we're here, right? We are pilgrims not by accident, but we are here on mission. There's something we're supposed to be doing. A couple of years ago, in a homiletics class that I was teaching with the Bible College Project, we were talking about application. And we went through this exercise as a class where we looked at different areas of life and identified how we might apply Jesus' words to love your neighbor as yourself in different areas of life. So we identified different areas of life. The kitchen. How do you love your neighbor as yourself in the kitchen? How do you love your neighbor as yourself in the bathroom? How do you love your neighbor as yourself in the soccer stadium? And one of those categories was the bus. How do you love your neighbor as yourself on the bus? And so we came up with a long list of possible ways, not rules that you have to live this way on the bus, but possible ways that I can apply my love for neighbor on the bus. And so thinking in terms that we've looked at this morning, how do I live an excellent life on the bus? Well, some of those answers were this. Letting people get on before me. I don't have to push to the front. Being kind to the bus driver or those people that get on the bus selling things. By throwing the trash in the trash can, not out the window. Not sticking my gum under the seat. Uruguayans drink mate, metal straw, gourd full of tea. Well, keep your thermos closed so you don't burn anybody with your hot water. Moving to the back of the bus so that people can get on. Taking the backpack off in the aisle so that I'm not bumping people. And on, we came up with ways, specific ways, to love your neighbor as yourself or to live excellent lives on the bus. Well, what would it look like? And we'll be done with this. What would it look like if we as Christians said, I'm a pilgrim. Pilgrim by God's grace. A pilgrim at war, a pilgrim on mission, that all needs to affect my life. And what if I lived that kind of life on the bus or at the office or in the house, and people, when they saw me coming, said, "Here comes a Christian." And instead of hanging onto their wallet, they say, "Here comes a Christian." And I don't know if I buy into that gospel that he's talking about, but I like the way she lives. She comes to work, he arrives on the scene, and things are better. He lives an excellent life. That, I believe, would glorify God. And that's why we're here. Because we're pilgrims, let's live excellent lives. Can we do this? By God's grace, we can do this. And he is desirous to help us.